The last two episodes of this series were harder to put together than I actually expected. The realities of what our mothers, our grandmothers, and our great-grandmothers went through, both spiritually and socioeconomically, took a heavy toll on me, and I would be lying if I said that there weren't moments where I fought back tears. But understanding the history of women's manyano and its context within the lives of Black women allowed me to have a clearer view of why my mother is so disapproving of my beliefs as someone who practices African spirituality. I won't say that our relationship is any better, but I was able to gain closure, the closure that I needed to move forward in my journey, and feeling much stronger in that I do not need to fight her, and I do not need to fight her past, but I can move on, understanding that she did what she felt was right to do. The research that I did helped me understand my mother's motivations and her view of the world. It also helped me understand my grandmother's experiences of the world. But throughout my conversations with my mother about her life, I realized that she very rarely spoke about her father. I know very little about my maternal grandfather, even though he was there throughout my mother's upbringing. All she ever says is that he worked at a beer hall, which somehow implied that he struggled with alcohol. It seemed as though him working at a beer hall led him to being spiritually absent in my mother's life. So I wanted to understand beer halls and what impact they actually had on Black society. My basic understanding of beer halls has always been that they were built in the townships by the apartheid government in order to basically weaponize the effects of alcohol. But what I found was a reality that was far, far more complicated and far more conflicted. In the last two episodes, I explored how, from the 1920s onwards, the migrant labor system that had forced many Black men to leave their homes in the rural areas to seek work in the mining towns had given birth to urban areas which would later evolve to become the townships as we know them today. Many Black women had also started to move to the urban areas, and while some were following their husbands, many more were going there to try to make a living for themselves and to try to provide for their families. However, during that time, Black women were prohibited from entering the formal employment sector. The past laws ensured that Black women could not move around easily. The majority of Black women who could find employment worked as helpers in white households. Others became washerwomen who did laundry for a fee, and others became street vendors. Even though the lives of Black people strained under the brutality of the colonial system, they still wanted to come together and to socialize. Singabantu, we are an inherently communal people, and when we came together, drink had to be involved. Customarily, it was the role of black women to brew traditional beer. Women would make traditional beer for their husbands or their friends and families. But there were also women in the urban areas who did not have husbands, and there were many men who did not have wives who could make the beer for them. So the women discovered that they could make traditional beer and sell it. Through this process, black men had found an outlet and black women had found a way out of poverty and dependence, and with that, the Shebeen Queen was born. Black men and women would gather at someone's place and share jars of umqombothi and cigarettes. There would be singing of traditional songs and nostalgic reminiscing about the good old days back emakhaya. The singing, just like the drinking, was also communal. Everyone participated. What made these scenes so important was that, for one thing, sharing of umqombothi was akin to evoking the presence of ancestors, and the music in and of itself carried the very identity of the people. The music carried the history, it carried the stories, and it carried knowledge. The people's spiritual essence was woven into the harmonies and the melodies called back to the times of old. Then came the gramophone, and with it, the Black American sound that came to be called jazz. The fusion of urban society and a people trying to reimagine themselves throughout communal song gave birth to a lifestyle. In places such as Doornfontein in Johannesburg, this lifestyle came to be called marabi. Marabi reflected the way of life of the people living in the slum yards. It was centered around beer brewing and shebeens. The marabi dance parties became centers of community life and gave the African working classes a new sense of identity. This is how Wilson Kingforce Selgi, a famous saxophonist, described marabi. Marabi was the environment. It was either an organ or mostly a piano. You get there, you pay your 10 cents, you get your share of whatever concoction there is, and you dance. It used to start from Friday night right through to Sunday evening. When we think of scenes like this, the name Sophia Town often conjures up images so vivid that you could almost smell them. Legendary writer Ken Temba describes one shebeen called 39 Steps like this. Now, this was a great shebeen. It was on Good Street. You walked up a flight of stairs. The structure looked dingy, as if it would crash down with you at any moment. You opened the door and walked into a dazzle of bright electric lights, contemporary furniture, and massive fatty. Oh, she was a legend. Gay, friendly, coquettish, always ready to sell you a drink. I've always been fascinated by the image of the Shebeen Queen and her complicated place in our society. More specifically, I've always wanted to understand how she created what in our modern woke language call a safe space for black identity to explore itself. To explore itself and reimagine itself in ways not heard of before. Back then, shebeens were not just a place to drink. It was where black intellectuals and writers gathered in order to formulate new ways of defining the black experience and imagining future possibilities for the black identity. To get a perspective on the realities of what happened when the black women's resourcefulness collided with music and culture and a people searching for themselves, I spoke to Muafrika Mukhati. Amongst many things, Muafrika is an astute poet, a prolific speaker, an award-winning radio presenter and producer who hosts an amazing jazz show on Trans Africa Radio. Muafrika is a co-founder of Hear My Voice, an NGO that uses poetry as a catalyst to address social issues. And in April 2019, she launched her debut poetry collection called My Tongue is a Rainbow.
You know, the story of Shabins and Shabin queens,
yes,
as they would refer to them. For me, the Shabin queens were the earliest women entrepreneurs. They were the first interaction of feminists, you know, in that era. They owned their sexuality. They would sleep with whoever, you know, they felt like. And most of the time, it will be single women, others who would marry, divorce and remarry quickly. Apparently, that's why they have so many rings. You know, you'd find that the Shabin queens have a number of rings on their fingers. Wow. So, they would put it here. So
they were not ashamed of it?
No, they were not ashamed of it. That's why the feminist excitement comes in play, you know, that I don't care, you know. But I guess it was beautiful to accessorize with. But Shabin queens played a very important role for musicians at the time. They created a space of belonging for Black people in the township. And this is even before the township. My maternal great-grandmother, or my mother's grandmother on her paternal side, was not really a Shabin queen, but she was selling homemade beer, lemutsoku, you know, homemade tobacco. So for me, that excited me to know that, you know what, that entrepreneurial bone was there. And it allowed people to gather. Because of some people, they don't want take away, but they want to sit. And it sparks conversation and, you know, everything comes out and the stories come out. But Shabins allowed people to gather, to have conversation of what is happening in society, how we can, you know, of society's ills, but to come up with ideas to better themselves. Because it's not like Black people never questioned what was happening, never questioned what white people were doing to them. They've always questioned. And these spaces allowed them to do that, you know. And music, when people are gathered, it is always a jovial thing. And I would like to believe that heba tubada babolela dinonwane or stories, there's always a musical element. So while batuba bodla, a song will come up. And whatever genre that might be, but music, booze, and a number of people, you know, it has always been a thing. The introduction of music would be traditional music, of course, and clapping.
What exactly is traditional music?
Traditional music, I mean, while music evolves, you know, people want to label things. But back then, I would say around the 40s, the 50s, or maybe even further, it was just music, because of it is what it is. It's us singing from joy, you know. It's like lululating. When someone is lululating, there's something that sparks, and something that tightens the tummy, and something that makes sound come out with jubilation. You know, it doesn't just come, but excitement and the diaphragm tightening. It's an exciting thing, you know.
Wow.
So sound will come out, and that will be music. But the other parts of the world would have a term for it. And then the sound that is coming out, Vusi, it's music. You don't have to label it. But while we are trying to sound intelligent, and then and now we are creating genres, we are creating all these labels of separating music, that's where you would find the term of traditional music, of world music. Now, what we would label as traditional music to the rest of the world is labeled world music. So it has always been music. And by that time, around the 1800s, there were intelligent black people who were traveling the world, you know, without restriction. So they will gather with people. There will be motsoko smoking. There will be beer drinking. And then when they come back, telling of their stories, there will be some excitement and sharing from their travels. With that part of the world influences, then the music will change. Mm. So Renare singing our own, what I would say is traditional music, right? And when they come with their influences of wherever music that they have traveled. So the music changes.
Mm.
And then when time goes on, from other parts of the country, the influences tap in. You would find Iskatamiya that is coming, that is bringing melody in. Iskatamiya as a form of meditation for the mine workers who are being rebellious and they don't want to make crazy noise, and they sing in that format, stamping softly to the ground in that format. And then you find workers in the farm who want to while away time, and they bring that element of music and what they call it, plantation music now, you know, because of they want to finish, and it becomes another genre itself that comes through.
Is that what was called Negro spirituals in America?
Yes, you know, and that is just music for the people, you know. Once people gather, there will be a song, you know. I mean, for me, Iskatamiya is one of the most powerful form of music. It's meditation. You just listen to it. Not now. Now it's a bit high paced, you know.
And it was slower back then.
It was slower.
Okay.
And then now, with the another label, the a cappella sound, trying to imitate musical instrument. So it's being also diluted somehow, or evolving, maybe not diluted as such, but that happens. But then coming back to the era from the time of Yamitsoku, now the cigarettes have been introduced. It's no longer Mkomboti, and then now we have the cartoon, you know, or even the spirits that are coming through. The sound also changed.
Really?
The gathering of people changed. That's where now we have Yoshebin Queens. The townships have been formed.
So it's almost like the chemical content of the alcohol changed the whole atmosphere.
And with the sound, I would love to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. Like the alcohol, the cigarettes or the tobacco, and the gathering of people, it changes. It changes with time, you know. Like also somehow I'm like vividly seeing it in my head that, you know, it's moving. It's no longer about bato like wearing animal skin lemitsoko that way never dishilang kachilwa, and then lemkomboti wasero, and then now we are moving from that. Then we are coming to the township, like you were saying, you know, that if these men are going to the mines and there are residents nearby, we are following these men. And now that's where we find ourselves in the townships, you know. And the sound also follows us.
Mm.
But coming to the jazz sound, because of people have been traveling and black people have been traveling.
Mm.
Your Charlotte Matlakes, they were singing in the 1800s. They were singing, you know, traveling the world. They were in New York, traveling, performing music, these people. So that when they come back now with these influences, jazz is born. And jazz is born with the influence of African sound. And remember that many of our people were taken, you know?
Mm.
So it's like now revisiting home and going back to the plantation miners' sound, music, you know, of whiling away time while they're working the fields. Now the beautiful sound of jazz is born, you know, which comes from home, Africa. And with the travelers, the ones who have the joy of going and coming back, introduce the lifestyle. And also, you know, now other settlers coming in and introducing all of these things and the spirits and, you know, the rolled tobacco, nicely packaged, all of these things, you know. And jazz becomes a refuge for people because of its sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's sound, it's music made from the heart.
Mm.
The blues is born. Also, again, time trotting, you know, you find your bebop coming in there.
Mm.
The era always changes, you know, and we find also that being trailed by this music.
Mm.
And in South Africa, with the South African influences, especially of Mbaqanga music, you know, by the Zulu people, comes in play to create a sound of African, of South African sound. Because of the South African sound, jazz sound is different to what you might find in Burundi, what you might find in Kenya.
Mm.
The traditional element,
because it's influenced by what was happening at
that time. It will always, when you listen to the jazz from the south, the jazz from the west, the jazz from the north, it's influenced by the traditional sound, or should I say the native sound of the land.
Mm.
It will always be there.
Mm.
You cannot take the sound or the original, the home sound from the people. You just can't.
Mm.
Why is that? The excitement, the feeling, the emotion, the tightening of the diaphragm, the excitement, the adrenaline, and the sound of liberation. That's how it is.
Mm.
So that will always carry the people. Much as you can bring different instruments, we have been making these instruments.
Mm.
You just saw them, and when you go back home, you just said, they are doing this.
Mm.
I think we can remodel what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
We have always had a piano. We have always had a grand piano. We had mbira. Like, all the keys of the piano, we have them in the mbira.
Mm.
It's just what is regarded as modern instruments is just African modified instruments. We've always had that.
Mm.
We've always had a trombone. We were using, you know, animal horns. The sound is so close to home.
Mm.
You know, you went back, you modified. It's always been there. So now the instrument, our native instruments are modified, and they come back made of silver, made of bronze, made of polished wood, and we want to play music because of music is us. When we are gathered, when there's beer, there's smoking of something, let's make music.
Mm.
So all these influences come through in South Africa, the very, very important connections of Mbaqanga come in to these jazz spaces.
Mm.
And also going back to the idea of belonging. Now you hear that somewhere across the oceans, they wear like this when they are playing this type of music. Mm. You know, you must wear this
red. And they dance like this.
Yes, wear the red dresses. The hairstyles are like this, you know.
And also because the tapping they know of the that feet. It's black people also on the other side. Yes. Doing that.
It's because of, I mean, when they hear this music, it's so close to home.
It's almost like they took the slaves and then with jazz music, the slaves came back.
Exactly that. That's why I think it was frustrating for black Americans to hear a South African black person who wants to play bebop, who wants to play the blues as they know it, but this person is coming from Africa. What is your sound? This happened when they approached Hugh Masekela, like, how you coming from Africa and you're playing like us? What happened? What are you playing at home now?
Mm.
And for him, it was like, oh, we do have sound, you know, a current sound, ekhaya, you know, like, then he had to revisit, you know, of which it was closer to home because of when there's a gathering, there will be that particular sound.
Mm.
And he tapped into that space, came back, did the African sound, boom. It's a sound that they have never heard, but there's a thread somewhere in there, you know, that connects the African bone between these black Americans and the black African, you know. it's sound. It's a thread. It's in our bones.
So when it was now happening in the Shebeens, because from what you're saying, I get a feeling that it was almost like the Shebeen Queens had created a space where the spirit of home could be channeled.
Yeah.
Like the spirit, you know, not even just the spirit of home, an ancient spirit of a people could be channeled into that space.
That's why, like, all this change, right? People are used to sit around the fire, hear stories, there will be song. And then now you are in the township, the city is buzzing, you're working, you are tired, you know, then you have your quarters at the madam's backyard, but you still need that fire to burn, to sit around people. And the Shebeen Queens really brought that. That excitement of hearing another story, another song. The Shebeen Queens brought that feeling of home. You know, it might not have been Umkomboti, they brought beers because of it was around that time and the economies of that time allowed that to happen. But a spirit of home, a spirit of being free, a spirit of dancing freely, you know, with all its influences. The Shebeen Queens have been there, you know, to create that space. And I think another thing that you've touched on, the presence of a mother in a homestead, the Shebeen Queen brought that feeling that should something happen, should something go wrong, there will be a mother figure to bring peace around this space. You know, like there will be a mother. The only voice that...
So they didn't lose their femininity or their maternal presence?
No. The Shebeen Queens played that part. The Shebeen Queen was that shadow, you know, in this buzzing and crazy space. The mother figure has always been there. You know? And wow. I think you find that there are certain men who would say, you know, free-spirited, I do whatever that I want. But then they will know that go mas ban ban, you can't do that. It brings that feeling of a mother figure. Like, no, rona ko mama. But kwale raitor, we must behave. You cannot touch the girls as willy-nilly as you please. She will show you where to get off. You know, that feeling, it never leaves the people. So women really also played a very important role in all of this. And another interesting part is how the Shebeen Queens, some of them, even though they could not sing, but they wanted to sing. somehow maybe they felt compelled that, you know what, okay, let me show you that I can do it. I mean, in some instances, going way back, it will be either Kuku who would be reciting mm-hmm. or singing this or sharing all these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the township, is this Shabin Queen somehow feeling compelled that I must sing? People are here. You know, it's like the crowd is right. The mood is right. So now let me sing. She will bimba all the way. You know, that's how it is. That's how it is. Like, let's do this. Yeah. You know, and your modified instruments.
Did I'm not sure about this.
Yeah.
But did scatting help?
It helps me as well. It helps. It goes back to scatami.
Okay.
The humming.
Yes.
Like, the humming. It's so like, listen to it. It's. Mm-hmm. It brings you to a peaceful state, like tranquility state. It's peaceful. And whatever words that you're singing, they will hit home. That is just how it is. So, skating, skatamia, it sounds, I don't want to say this, I know that it sounds like Asian sound, but they use it with and the instrument, it looks like a violin, but you mm-hmm. put it on the table and it creates the ding 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 sound, you know. But we do that with our voices,
mm-hmm.
and Iskatamiya does that to the music space, and the skating also. It's like a form of prayer. You know, I don't want to skate. I can tell her, like, it's like, okay, now give us the taste of skating. I won't skate. But it brings that even though you cannot understand the message behind the song or the lyrics mm-hmm. behind the song, but just to hum it through. And it happens even now. A person might not know the lyrics or even the message behind the song, but they will remember the melody. This song was like this. Dun, 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 de, dun, dun, bun, bun. Someone might pick it up.
Mm.
It's closer to home. We've always been the Batwa Matsoho. So mm. sound will always capture our people much more.
Mm.
Skating for Shabin Queens, get away with it. It will pay the bills. People, more people will be coming. But yeah, the influence came through from Africa, traveled. And I would love to believe that Black people were coming full circle, you know, through music.
Mm.
And yeah, the first feminist Shabin Queens were there to play that integral role to remind people of who they are, of coming home to themselves.
In many ways, the Shabin Queen was the epitome of a self-empowered woman. What many Black women strive for today is exactly what the Shabin Queen achieved way back in the 1930s. But this success did not go unnoticed, because what Shabin owners were actually doing was not just selling alcohol, but they were upsetting the status quo of the time. In one way, the success of the Shabins upended the cultural structure of the traditional Black family. With the profit of running a good Shabin often outstripping the income of men, relations between the Shabin Queen and her husband or male partner could be overturned in favor of the woman. The Shabin Queen could start dictating the terms within the family. Also, in order to create a conducive environment for people to buy alcohol and to stay for a long time, the Shabin Queen had to be friendly with the male customers. After all, she was not ashamed of her sexuality and she was in full ownership of it. In terms of the government, Shabins were a part of a system that served to redistribute money within Black communities as a whole. Together with other cooperatives such as Stockfels and Spaza Shops and other street vendors, Shebeens form part of a redistributive cycle of capital. The independence of the Shebeens presented a very real threat to the government in its effort to keep black people completely disempowered and incapacitated. In 1928, the Liquor Act was passed and it was declared that black people were not allowed to make or sell alcohol of any kind. The government decided to set up its own beer halls in order to get the money that the Shebeens were making. To enforce this law, the police conducted regular raids where they would destroy any alcohol that would find at anyone's home, and they would also arrest anyone who was involved in the manufacturing of alcohol. In 1936, for example, out of the 344,000 convictions secured against the black people at the time, 107,000 were for liquor-related offenses compared to a mere 71,000 for pass laws. That means that more people were arrested for selling alcohol than for any other offense, even not carrying a dom pass. The majority of those convictions were black women. In order to overcome this challenge, the ever-resourceful black women devised different ways of avoiding the raids. One way was to hide the barrels used to ferment the alcohol underground. Huge holes were dug up and the barrels were hidden out of sight. That way, should the police come, they would only find the alcohol that had already been poured into the jam jars that the patrons were drinking, and not the main stock. But the issue with making umqombothi was that it took a long time to ferment, a week sometimes. This meant that there was a slow turnover and a police raid could see large volumes spilled. In order to shorten the time, different concoctions had to be devised. These new concoctions had to be able to be made faster and had to be more potent in order for them to be sold quicker in smaller amounts, thereby increasing revenue with less effort. Now, it is important to understand how umqombothi is different from any other type of alcoholic beverage. Research has found that, in terms of food value, 2 liters of traditional beer supplies approximately 39% of the total protein requirements for an adult, whereas distilled liquor supplies none. Previous investigations have shown that traditional beer is a good source of vitamin B. Therefore, by supplying protein and vitamin B, traditional beer fulfills the roles of a supplementary foodstuff. Also, probably most importantly, due to its low alcohol content and thick texture, there is a physical limit to how much one can drink umqombothi. The primary intoxicant of all fermented drinks is, of course, alcohol. The secondary products of fermentation are fusel oils, which are commonly held to be responsible for the hangover. Research has shown that traditional beer has lower fusel oil content than your average beer. What all of this means is that when the chemical content of traditional beer changed, its role and function within society also changed. The battle between the Shebeens and government beer halls led to more and more potent iterations of traditional beers. The government, having an obvious advantage, could afford to be strategic with its beer halls. For one thing, many beer halls are located near bus stops in most townships. Remember that old Black Label ad, the one that had those overly muscular mine workers with cases of beers on their shoulders? Well, it presented the idea of the beer drinker being a hero who deserved a cold beer at the end of the day. Well, the premise was based on how the beer halls functioned, because as soon as you got off the bus from work, there was a beer hall right in front of you. Eventually, the government made so much money from the beer halls that in some areas, the profits from the halls far exceeded the taxes that the government received. Literally all the money that was needed to run those municipalities came from the sale of alcohol. In time, Shebeens also eventually started selling Western beers and spirits in order to increase profits. By the time 1994 came, many beer halls had either been demolished or converted into recreational facilities. But Shebeens, on the other hand, had continued to flourish. With that success, more and more black men stayed away longer from their families. The grip that alcohol had on our society grew stronger, and the strength of our spirituality grew even more diluted, to the point where I don't think I need to tell you what alcohol has done to Black people. Our history is complicated. Our history is conflicted. Whenever we want to talk about African spirituality, we tend to feel compelled to dip it in beautiful poetry or self-affirming grand imagery of gold-encrusted bygone eras. I suppose it is to make it more palatable for us more than anyone else. But our history is also real. It is ever-changing and evolving. The Shebeen Queens are as integral to our history as any great Sanusi is, because we see their impact in how we practice our ceremonies today. It was them who introduced these whiskies and brandies and such spirits into our collective lived experience. These are the same spirits that are fundamentally integral to all our rituals and ceremonies. Sometimes I get asked, why is it that we have to offer our ancestors alcohol, especially when we are conducting imisebenzi? Like, the question is usually along the lines of, where do they know brandy and gin from if they're Black ancestors? Well, to start off with, the practice of offering beverages of any kind is called libations, and it is a practice that is there in almost all spiritual belief systems throughout the world. It is there in every society, in every era, from ancient Sumeria to the ancient Greeks. It is there in the Bible, and it is there in Egyptian hieroglyphs. The question of why we as Black South Africans offer our ancestors specific types of alcohol needs to be understood from a perspective of, why do we offer anything in the first place? The answer is symbolism. Here's an example. Why do you text your partner, "I love you"? Why do you buy your lover flowers? Those flowers are eventually going to die and end up in the bin. Those flowers carry no other value than as a symbol of a connection that you are trying to evoke at that very moment when you're offering them. You are creating a channel through which you and your partner can connect for a very specific meaning. Those flowers are a physical offering to something that is not physical at all. You are offering those flowers to love itself. The kind of flowers that you offer is only relevant based on who it is that you're giving them to. We don't offer our ancestors beverages because somehow we believe that they can physically drink them. We do it because we're establishing a channel through symbolism. Utjwala to us as Abantu represents the spirit of communality. When our ancient ones came together, they shared drink. When we prepare for umsebenzi, we offer drink because we are summoning a gathering on every dimension and every time frame. The different kinds of beverages that we offer is all a testament to our evolving history. Our history is alive because we are alive. At the time of publishing this episode, South Africa, like much of the world, is under lockdown in the fight against the coronavirus. Things right now are extremely uncertain. We don't know what the future holds. And just like our predecessors, a lot is counting on what we decide to do today. Generations down the line are gonna look back at us and ask us why we did the things that we did and why we didn't do the things that we didn't do. What we must always remember is that every generation is responsible for its own decisions. I am hopeful and I'm trusting that we are able to hold on to our spirituality, to the true essence of who we are. And when this dark period passes, we will be able to build a much better future, not just for ourselves, but for all our descendants. My name is Vusumzi Nqande, and this is the Journey Kwantu. I wish you courage, and I wish you all the very best on your journey. Makwande.